From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, poor weather conditions are blamed for the crash of the Air Asia jet into the Java Sea.
And we have radio playback tapes from the Indonesians showing this plane descending at between 11,000 feet and 24,000 feet a minute, which indicates you're in a very severe downdraft.
Taiwan's former president Chen Shui-bian is paroled from prison, and Cambodia works to end cheating in school exams. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. As the search for and recovery of victims and debris from the December 28th crash of Air Asia Flight 8501 continues, Indonesia's meteorological agency said bad weather was the triggering factor behind the accident of the Airbus A320. The twin-engine jetliner fell into the Java Sea on a flight from Surabaya, Indonesia, to Singapore, killing all 162 people on board. The agency said, based on an analysis of existing meteorological data, the most probable weather phenomenon was icing, which can cause engine damage. But Jeffrey Thomas, editor of the Australian air safety website, airlineratings.com, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he believes a more likely cause of the crash was a sharp downdraft in thunderstorms the flight crew was trying to avoid.
Now, we don't know what the altitude of those cloud tops are. They could be 65, 70,000 feet. The plane's operating at 32,000 feet, so the temperature would be somewhat warmer down there. Now, aircraft regularly fly in temperatures of minus 70, 75, even higher. So that wouldn't impact the aeroplane as far as the coldness is concerned. What they also suggested that ice may have been involved, and the engines, they may have flamed the engines out and ingested the ice. If that was the case, losing your engines, both of them, at that altitude is certainly a problem. However, you would normally have control of the plane. They are fabulous gliders, and they'll glide for about 30 minutes as you descend, and you'd have plenty of time to do a mayday. So that was one interpretation. The other thing is, if you are encountering ice, you're in the middle of a thunderstorm, and you're in the middle of a major downdraft. And ice is your least of your problems. The downdraft is your major problem, because those downdrafts can be up to 100 miles an hour. And we have radio playback tapes from the Indonesians showing this plane descending at between 11,000 feet and 24,000 feet a minute, which indicates you're in a very severe downdraft. This weather report, while interesting, because we know it was in some serious weather, the interpretation of the report and some of the comments are a little bit misleading.
As you know, the flight crew attempted to change its flight path, but was denied by air traffic control. Is that going to be reviewed, do you think?
Well, no. I mean, aircraft are constantly asking for permission to change altitude, and you're held down for a bit longer. I think it was about 2 or 3 minutes later that they were actually given permission to climb to 34,000 feet, not the 38 they wanted. The big question is, was it possible for him to be in what we suspect was a severe thunderstorm situation? Was his radar set correctly? Was it being interpreted correctly?
Could the flight crew have issued some sort of urgent appeal that would have prompted air traffic control to give it permission to deviate?
Well, what they could have done is they could have gone into an orbit. If a pilot sees a major thunder cell in front of him, he can't go through it. If he's faced with this, he would simply say to ATC, I can't penetrate this. I need to go into an orbit until you sort out what I can do, because I can't proceed. Other aeroplanes were crossing through this weather system. There were six other aircraft in the area at the time. It would appear as though this was intensely localized, and I just think he just misread it. He just misread the intensity or misread the size, because he's possibly, his radar wasn't set correctly.
No pings yet picked up to locate the black boxes. Is that a problem?
It's a very interesting situation, because they've found supposedly five pieces. The dimensions of the pieces are rather interesting, and one particular piece, and I'll get to the pings in a second, one particular piece is 18 metres long by 5.4 metres wide. Now, 5.4 metres wide worries me, because an A320's fuselage is only 3.7 metres wide. So, you know, they say it's the fuselage. Well, if it is the fuselage, it's a bit too wide to be the fuselage. But, you know, let that one go. But what worries me is that if they've located these big pieces and they can't locate the pings, then are they the right pieces? Because if they've found that they're, you know, they're sitting over the top of these pieces in their ships, they'll have a pinger locator there as well, and they haven't located anything. So is the other debris from this plane, you know, well away somewhere else? There's a lot of question marks about the information we're getting, and a lot of things don't add up at this stage.
Jeffrey Thomas says compensation to the families of the victims of the December 28th crash may be affected by the airline's apparent lack of permission from Indonesia to fly the Surabaya to Singapore route on Sundays. However, Singapore's Civil Aviation Authority said the carrier had been approved to fly the route daily. Former Taiwan President Chen Shui-bian left prison today on medical parole after several years due to declining health. Mr. Chen had served less than a third of his prison term. He was imprisoned on charges related to graft during his time in office, when he also angered Taiwan's political rival China by seeking the island's independence. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA in Taipei.
Taiwan's ex-president Chen Shui-bian left prison Monday for his family's home in South Taiwan. He was 6 years into a 20-year sentence for bribery, money laundering, and other corruption-related charges. His lawyer, Shi Yilin, said he had developed severe depression and incontinence, among other ailments. He says the ex-president's condition had developed to where he lacked dignity. When he wants to talk to us, Shi says, it takes someone else to push his wheelchair, and he walks with a cane. The lawyer adds that 15 medical experts have unanimously said Mr. Chen could be given treatment outside prison and that this outcome should be in accordance with the law. When in office from 2000 to 2008, Mr. Chen made a name for distancing self-ruled Taiwan from China, which claims the island as its own. Beijing fumed because Mr. Chen would not agree that China and Taiwan belong to the same country, and he advocated for drafting a new constitution that was widely believed would advance Taiwan's independence. The standoff made most dialogue impossible and prompted military threats from China. Mr. Chen also irked the United States, which wanted stronger China-Taiwan relations. Washington eventually restricted Chen's transit on U.S. soil when he was flying from Taiwan to diplomatic allies in Latin America. Since 2008, President Ma Ying-jeou has eased ties with both superpowers, leading to 21 landmark agreements with China. In 2009, a court convicted Mr. Chen of graft-related charges involving $20 million, making him Taiwan's first ex-president to serve time for crimes in office. His wife and two other family members were also convicted. Mr. Chen disputes all charges, calling them part of a political plot. The Justice Ministry's Agency of Corrections said Monday Mr. Chen could live at home because his neurological condition had deteriorated to where it could not be treated in prison. The agency said it had factored justice and humanitarianism into its decision. Last week, a 15-person team of medical experts also recommended that the agency grant medical parole. Deputy Justice Minister Chen Ming-tong gave a news conference Monday summarizing the findings of medical experts. He says Chen Shui-bian's neurological health has severe disabilities. He's not able to get by on his own in normal life now and needs to be examined, cared for, and given assistance regularly, the official says, so we think medical treatment cannot be effective in prison. Political analysts say the former president's medical parole will satisfy a faction of opposition party supporters who felt he had served enough time, but that his release will have no major impact on Taiwan politics. Some believe Monday's decision shows that the ruling Nationalist Party, which lost to Mr. Chen's opposition Democratic Progressive Party in local elections November 29, may have allowed medical parole to appear conciliatory. The corrections agency said Chen Shui-bian must return to prison in as little as a month if health exams find him fit. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
South Korea has called new U.S. financial sanctions against North Korea appropriate, while Pyongyang described them as counterproductive. VOA's Victor Beatty reports President Obama's executive order Friday targeting three North Korean entities and 10 individuals followed a cyber attack on Sony Pictures that Washington blames on North Korea.
A South Korean Unification Ministry spokesman Monday said Seoul considers the new sanctions an appropriate measure. However, he declined to say how it might impact the North-South relationship. On Sunday, North Korea denounced the U.S. action as a hostile act aimed at saving face, despite what the statement called international skepticism over the results of a U.S. investigation that blames the North for the November cyber attack on Sony Pictures. Pyongyang has offered to conduct a joint investigation with the United States into the hacking, which resulted in the publication of sensitive information and the loss of revenue for the media company. The attack was linked to the release of the film The Interview, a comedy about an assassination plot against North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Pyongyang denounced the film, although it has denied any involvement in the Sony hacking. A group calling itself Guardians of Peace did claim responsibility. In a statement last month, the Federal Bureau of Investigation concluded the North Korean government was responsible, citing an analysis of the malware and infrastructure used. However, media reports quoting cyber experts have cast doubt on the extent of Pyongyang's involvement. Friday, the U.S. Treasury Department identified three organizations, including North Korea's primary intelligence organization, along with 10 individuals with links to arms exports for targeted sanctions, including a denial of access to the U.S. financial system. That would effectively limit their access to international financial services. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew said the steps underscore that the United States will employ a broad set of tools to defend U.S. businesses and citizens and to respond to attempts to undermine our values or threaten the national security of the United States. President Obama called the additional sanctions a response to the North's ongoing provocative, destabilizing, and repressive actions and policies. The White House called the response proportional and suggested it was only the first step. Sunday, outgoing Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Robert Menendez said on U.S. television the sanctions were a good first step, but said the U.S. needs to look at putting the North back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Troy Stangerone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute says the sanctions will accomplish two objectives. He refers to the 2007 U.S. decision to cut ties with Macau-based Banco Delta Asia for its alleged business dealings with North Korea.
There will probably be a small short-term to maybe medium-term financial hit for the North Koreans, which seems to be where the administration is going. I think they're viewing proportional response as this cost Sony a certain amount of money. We're going to try and hit North Korea in the pocketbook as well. But in terms of long run, you know, we saw after BDA, the North Koreans took and began changing how they handled money, picking up into smaller accounts, moving it through different channels to try and evade future financial sanctions. My guess is that while this may impede some of their arms shipments and things in the short term, that they'll essentially follow the same pattern and try to reroute things, and that in the long run, this will have minimal impact.
Stangerone says while putting North Korea back on the state sponsors of terrorism list might be the next step, further financial sanctions are also possible, given President Obama's recent assessment that the Sony attack was an act of cyber vandalism. On New Year's Day, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said he was open to expanding dialogue and cooperation with South Korea. The South earlier offered to hold high-level meetings with North Korea this month. Stangerone does not believe that will be impacted by the new sanctions, saying the Obama administration is trying to compartmentalize the situation.
The State Department had put out a statement saying that they supported South Korean efforts to reach out to North Korea. I think anything that happens between the North and the South will probably take time to develop. Even if we see a summit, as Kim Jong-un suggested, that most likely wouldn't be until later in the year after any response to the cyber attack would have taken place, and there would have been an opportunity for the South Koreans to lay the groundwork for something like that. So I think in terms of inter-Korean relations, I don't see it having much impact.
Stangerone says it is unclear whether North Korea will accept the format offered by the South, which includes a new unification committee. But the fact that Kim Jong-un did not reject it during his New Year's Day remarks is positive. Stangerone says the Koreas need to take a step-by-step approach in order to build up a consistent rapport. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has promised the Iraqi government more help to fight Islamic State militants. Mr. Abbott made the pledge today during a previously unannounced visit to Iraq. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian government already has joined US-led airstrikes against Islamic State targets in northern Iraq. It's also promised to send 200 Special Forces soldiers to act as military advisers to the Iraqi army. On Monday, Tony Abbott made his first visit as Australia's Prime Minister to Baghdad. and has promised his counterpart, Haider al-Abadi, that Canberra would do what it could to help defeat Sunni militants who've seized large parts of Iraq and neighbouring Syria. Mr. Abbott says the Iraqi people continue to be oppressed.
Iraq is a country which has suffered a very great deal. First, decades of tyranny under Saddam Hussein, then the chaos and confusion that followed the American-led invasion, most recently the tumult, the dark age which has descended upon northern Iraq as a result of the Daesh death cult.
Prime Minister Abbott says efforts to defeat Islamic State militants are not just a struggle for Iraq, but a global fight. The Australian leader says the Sunni militants had declared war against the world. During his previously unannounced visit to Baghdad, Mr. Abbott also met Iraqi President Fawad Massoum and was briefed by US and Australian military commanders. He also spent time with Australian forces at their base in Iraq. Australia will also donate another $4 million in humanitarian assistance to help feed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who've been displaced and had crops destroyed by terrorist attacks. Australia's support for the US-led campaign against Islamic State militants stems from a long-standing military alliance dating back to the early 1950s. In recent months, Canberra has passed new counter-terrorism laws in an attempt to stop young Australians travelling to join militants in Iraq and Syria. Last year, Canberra raised its domestic terror threat level from medium to high because of concerns about homegrown extremism. Critics of Australia's military involvement in Iraq insist it's made Australia more of a target for terrorists. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Cambodia's final exam results for 2014 were disastrous, with more than half of the 90,000 students failing. The reason? The authorities stamped out cheating, the first of a series of reforms designed to fix the impoverished country's broken education sector. Robert Carmichael reports for VOA from Phnom Penh.
The decision to stamp out cheating had a huge impact. 60% of the class of 2014 failed their final year of school, despite getting a second chance to retake their tests in October. The class of 2015 has taken note. Final year student Ratanar says his peers realise the no cheating in exams rule means they will need to apply themselves to pass and get into university.
The new policy means we are studying harder and not going out as much as we used to. It also means we won't have to spend money during exams.
The new policy is courtesy of this man. Appointed a year ago after a decade as a deputy finance minister, Education Minister Hang Chun Naron says reforming education is critical to Cambodia's development.
So the most important factor is that the school skill mismatch in Cambodia, and it becomes an obstacle to economic development, to growth, to attracting foreign direct investment. So we have, you know, investors coming in, they look for skilled labor force. We don't have enough. But at the supply side, we have many graduates that cannot find job. And this is a problem that many countries are facing, the skill mismatch.
The new policy aims for improved teacher training, better school governance, and promoting critical thinking and problem solving for Cambodia's 2.9 million school-age children. Underpaid teachers will earn more and schools will get increased funding from an education budget that will rise sharply to $440 million. Cambodia certainly has a long way to go. Its ratio of 46 pupils per primary school teacher, for instance, is the worst in the world outside Africa. The Asian Development Bank is providing $90 million over 5 years to improve the quality of education and cut the dropout rate. The ADB's Sapir Mar applauds the government's decision to boost education spending, but says at 17% of expenditure, it's still low.
Budget allocation is important, but also expenditure, even more important. And this is a big challenge because, the capacity at the school level, at the sub-national level, remain an issue. So reform is not just only taking place within the ministry, the reform had to start from the classroom, had to start from the lower level.
Ensuring these reforms succeed, he says, will need the backing not only of government, but of students, parents, and the private sector. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
This is VOA News.
This is Today in History. On January 5th, 1757, French King Louis XV narrowly escaped death at the hands of would-be assassin Robert Damiens. The king survived with only a slight wound. Damiens would be tried, convicted, and then gruesomely drawn and quartered in a public execution. On this day in 1779, American naval hero Stephen Decatur was born. He's best known for the role he played in defeating the Barbary Pirates of North Africa. The pirates had attacked non-Muslims for years, often taking Christian hostages as slaves. The pirates ran afoul of the American government when they began raiding U.S. vessels and holding their crews hostage. In 1876, German statesman Konrad Adenauer was born. In a public career that spanned 60 years, Adenauer is best known as the first chancellor of post-war West Germany, an office he held for 14 years. In 1914, the Ford Motor Company announced it was doubling the size of its minimum wage for its workers to $5 an hour and trimming its workday to 8 hours. Higher productivity resulted, forcing many competitors to follow suit. On this day in 1933, construction began on one of America's most famous bridges. It would be more than 4 years before San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge would open to the public. Also in 1933, America's 30th president died. Calvin Coolidge, a man of few words, was often referred to as Silent Cal. In 1940, Edwin H. Armstrong demonstrated FM broadcasting in a long-distance relay network via 5 stations. Later that year, a part of the radio spectrum was reserved for FM, which would become the dominant method of radio transmission in much of the world. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Corruption affects countries around the world. Its forms and impact may vary, but the results are corrosive nonetheless, undermining democracy, stifling economies, thwarting justice, diverting resources, and ruining the futures of nations. The moral and practical costs of corruption are no longer debatable, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. Corruption drives instability, popular protests, and revolutions. In some cases, these popular movements produce democratic reform, but in other cases, they produce a power vacuum or an authoritarian backlash. Frustration with corruption can also drive insurgency movements and be exploited by terrorist groups to gain popular support. And the proceeds of corruption, which are often sheltered in banks or shell corporations in Western Europe and the United States, enable terrorist financing and sustain unaccountable regimes. And that is why the United States is using every tool at its disposal to advance its anti-corruption agenda. Addressing corruption is tough, but we are using a range of tools and often working with other states and international institutions to encourage and assist anti-corruption activity, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. So we are pressing other states to live up to the international anti-corruption commitments they've made. The United States is also enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and providing some $600 million a year to build the capacity of foreign governments to combat corruption. Still, said Undersecretary Sewell, the biggest factor in the success or failure of anti-corruption efforts is a matter of political will on the part of governments. The willingness to use the power of the law against the biggest violators, regardless of who they are or what political party they support. We renew our notice to kleptocrats around the world. Continued theft from your communities will not be tolerated, and the international community is committed to denying safe haven to you and your illicit assets, wrote Secretary Kerry. We call on partners in government, civil society, and the private sector to join us in fighting corruption. We also call on countries undergoing democratic transition to redouble their efforts to build governments that are accountable to citizens and respect the rule of law.